Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now attempting to do Exodus chapter 21. This chapter concerns slavery and restitution. I don't know if I can do the whole chapter today. Slavery takes up the first portion of it. And if I find that I have gone too long discussing that, I will break this audio up into two and then do another audio on the last half of the chapter, which is restitution. Our context is this. The Ten Commandments have been given in the last chapter, Exodus chapter 20, and we have seen the children of Israel standing before Mount Sinai, which is thick with cloud, gloom, and darkness, and lightning, and thunder, and earthquake. The people have said, we don't want to talk to God, we're too scared, you go talk to him. So Moses is talking to God. I'm not sure whether he's gone back up on the mountain or whether he's standing below the mountain talking to God, but whatever, he's talking to God. And now God is giving all of the details in the so-called Book of the Covenant, the details of what the Ten Commandments summarizes. So we start now in Exodus 21, verses 1 and 2. Now these are the ordinances which you, God's talking to Moses, are to set before them, before the people of Israel. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. Now these ordinances which God is speaking to Moses, I assume it's with an audible voice out of the cloud. This was in the presence of the people, just like the Ten Commandments were spoken with an audible voice in the presence of the people. I don't know whether the people were close enough to hear here because of the fear of the thunder and the lightning. And also in Exodus 20, verse 21, it says they were standing, quote unquote, far off. But Moses is hearing it. Somebody's hearing it. Now, here is what Adam Clark says about these ordinances, quote, these different regulations are as remarkable for their justice and prudence as for their humanity. Their great tendency is to show the valuableness, which I think he should have said the value, of human life and the necessity of having peace and good understanding in every neighborhood. And they possess that quality which should be the object of all good and wholesome laws, the prevention of crimes. Most criminal codes of jurisprudence seem more intent on the punishment of crimes than on preventing the commission of them. The law of God always teaches and warns that his creatures may not fall into condemnation, for judgment is his strange work, i.e., one reluctantly and seldom executed. Well, I guess you could say that the law is more merciful if its punishments are stricter, which would then prevent people from committing crimes in the first place. As, for example, I doubt very seriously whether there were very many instances of adultery. I doubt very seriously whether there were any instances of homosexuality. I doubt same for bestiality, same for rebellious kids. I just don't think there was that much of it because they were in so much terror of the law. But at any rate, as we go through this, we will see how just the law is, despite the fact that some atheists and skeptics and anti-Christian types like to say how barbaric it is. It was not barbaric. It's not meant for modern day societies, by the way, because this is the law of Moses. It was meant for an ancient Near Eastern society walking through a desert with enemies on every side. All right, let's start out with the law of slavery. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years. Now I'm going to give you an overview of Hebrew slavery, and I'm just to briefly summarize it. I want to show how humane the law of Hebrew slavery was, especially as when compared to Roman law or American slavery or English slavery. First of all, slaves were regarded as full members of the community. Genesis 17:12 says this, throughout your generations, every male among you is to be circumcised at 8 days old, every male born in your household or purchased from any foreigner and not your offspring. So if you were a slave, you were just like a son. You got circumcised and you're a member of the household. A slave received the same rest periods and holidays as non-slaves. We look at Exodus 23:12. Do your work for 6 days, but rest on the seventh day so that your ox and your donkey may rest and the son of your female slave, as well as the resident alien may be refreshed. The son of your female slave is going to rest just like everybody else is going to rest. The family members are going to rest. The ox, the donkeys are going to rest. The sojourners, the resident aliens are going to rest. And the slaves are going to rest. Deuteronomy 5:14. All right, as we continue to look at scriptures that show that slaves were treated humanely in the Hebrew law, We've seen they were regarded as full members of the community as they were circumcised along with the family members. And now we're looking at scriptures that show that they had the same rest period and holidays as non-slaves, Deuteronomy 5:14. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. Do not do any work, you, your son or daughter, your male or female slave. Your male or female slave, do not do any work. Your ox or donkey and so forth, or the resident alien who lives within your city gates, so that your male and female slaves may rest as you do. Deuteronomy 12, verse 12, first part of the verse. You will rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female slaves. And of course, rejoicing there is talking about going to feast and festivals. So the slaves were part of the family. They went to feast and festivals. They took Sabbath rest along with the rest of the family. But the most important provision of the law, which mitigated conditions for a slave, was this. Slavery was not intended as a permanent condition. It was rather a voluntary, temporary refuge for people suffering desperate poverty. We read in Exodus 21, verse 2, when you buy a Hebrew slave, he is to serve for 6 years. Then in the seventh, he is free as a free man without paying. He is to leave as a free man without paying anything. So you see, a slave couldn't be held longer than 6 years. And of course, those 6 years, we'll talk in a minute about what caused people to become slaves, but those 6 years were with a master who had to feed him and clothe him and put a roof over his head and so forth. And then the slave would know that he's not going to be doing this forever in 6 years, or 6 or 5 or 4 or 3 or 2 or 1 years, depending on depending on an interpretation of that seventh year freedom period, the slave could get to go free. So it's not like in slavery in the American South, or most slavery, where you're stuck forever until you get bought out. This slavery in the Hebrew law, slaves could walk free without paying a thing. It says right here in Exodus 21:2, on the seventh day, he is to leave as a free man without paying anything. In other words, he doesn't have to buy his freedom. Also, cruelty on the part of the owner resulted in immediate freedom for the slave. We read in this chapter, Exodus 21, verses 26 and 27, when a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he must let the slave go free in compensation for his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his male or female slave, you must let the slave go free in compensation for his tooth. And I assume that would be intentional striking of the eye and tooth, and maybe negligent, and probably negligent striking of the eye or the tooth also. So you see, in general, these laws are very, very humane as far as slavery is concerned. That doesn't mean that the law advocates slavery. It just means it's regulating an institution that already existed. The law does not advocate slavery any more than it advocates polygamy. It's just regulating an institution that already exists amongst fallen, sinful human beings to try to make things a little bit better. To say that the Old Testament advocates slavery is like saying that the city of New York advocates prostitution because they have laws against prostitution. I think they do. I don't know. Maybe they're all up in the governor's office. I don't know. But typically, cities will regulate prostitution. That doesn't mean they're in favor of it. Now, how might a Hebrew become a slave? There are several ways. The first way is poverty. Leviticus 25:39 says this, if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. Now, we'll talk about what that means when we get to Leviticus as far as to how the master would treat him. But obviously, he's not to be treated poorly. And that verse also shows that that's how you might become a slave. You can't pay your debt, and so you sell yourself to your creditor. In other words, your freedom is your collateral. It's not your house you give him, not your car you give him, but you give him yourself. Now again, showing how someone might become a slave through poverty, Exodus 21:7 says, if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. That means she's not to go because she's being sold as a concubine, and the concubine is married, so she will not go free after the 6 year like a male slave would. But my point here is not that, but that we see a man selling his daughter as a slave. Why would a father do that? It's because he can't pay his debts. So he says, well, I owe you, Mr. Creditor, but instead of paying you money, I'll let you marry my daughter. That's basically how that works. A man might become a slave because of theft, the sale price being paid to the victim of the theft. For example, in Exodus 22:3, but if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So if you owe a creditor something, You can't pay him money, so you pay him with your labor for 6 years, and then you free the seventh year. Now, when we get to the laws of restitution, we'll see that if somebody steals something, he pays back what he can with his money, plus a premium, pays back the value of what he stole plus a premium. But if he owns nothing, he can't pay it back. Well, there's no other choice. He has to go into slavery. Instead of paying him back with property, he pays him back with his freedom and his service, his labor. If a man goes into debt, he could become a slave. 2 Kings 4:1. Now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." So again, selling a child into slavery for debt is the same thing as selling a daughter into slavery for debt. You can't pay the creditor, so you let the creditor take your family members so they can work for you. A slave could be a prisoner of war. An opposing nation could take the Hebrew as a POW. And then, of course, this is very common in ancient warfare. The soldiers would capture their prisoners, then they would sell them as slaves to get some booty, if you will. And then the family members would have to come redeem them out of slavery. Same thing could happen to an Israelite if he got caught by one of these pagan nations and became a slave. Then an Israelite would have to come buy him back out as a slave. Back out of slavery, a family member. Another thing that might happen is a Hebrew might ransom a Hebrew slave from a Gentile owner and then sell that slave to another Hebrew. And when that happens, get to the seventh year, the Hebrew goes free. Now, this idea of freeing the slave on the seventh year, this follows a divine pattern. We know that creation was done in 7 days. We know that God instituted a weekly Sabbath. We know that God says that for 7 years, the Sabbath are to lie fallow and not be planted, be plowed up but not planted. That's every 7 years. So you got a Sabbath day every 7 days, then every seven you have a Sabbath, and every 7 years you have a Sabbath year. And then, of course, you got the year of Jubilee, which is after seven Sabbath years. 7 times 7 is 49, so the 49th year is a Sabbath year, and then the 50th year is the year of Jubilee, which is based on that pattern of seven. Now, the idea of the seventh year, if the seventh year is fixed by the calendar, that means that slaves might be enslaved for 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, or 1 year, depending on when in the cycle that they are sold into slavery. And, of course, their price to redeem would get less and less and less as each year rolled by. But I tend to think that the 6 years is fixed not by the calendar, but by the date of purchase. So that if you sell yourself into slavery, you've got 6 years and then you get out, no matter when during the calendar year, or when during the, no matter which year you sell yourself into slavery, no matter when that seventh year comes, it doesn't matter. The Sabbath year that comes after every 6 years in the Jewish calendar, that calendar cycle doesn't matter when you calculate when the slave is freed, I don't think. I think it refers to the fact that it's 6 years after the slave has been bought, whenever that occurs. So every slave has to serve 6 years before he goes free. It's not that some slaves serve 6 years, some five, some four, some three, some two, or some 1 year, as Adam Clark believes. But that's up in the air. It's not really clear. Now, the fact that the slave is freed in the seventh year, this is symbolic of the fact that following the law led to freedom. Freedom. You got 6 years of slavery, you're in bondage, and whoa, now you're free. This would be, of course, as opposed to the slavery in Egypt. As the NIV Study Bible says, the Lord's servants are not to be anyone's perpetual slaves. Now, the verse here says that he in the seventh year, he is to be free without any payment. He shall go out as a free man without payment. Actually, it's the other way around, because when he goes out as a free man, the master has to pay the slave to help him get started in his new life. We see this in Deuteronomy 15, verses 13 and 14. When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flock and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give him as the Lord your God has blessed you. In other words, the richer you are, the more you've been blessed, the more you give your freed slave. So you see that slavery was a relatively humane institution, although nobody wanted to be a slave, of course. But it could be a lot worse. And there were other slavers all throughout human history that were a lot worse. We go to Exodus 21, verses 3 and 4. If he, that's the slave, comes alone, comes into slavery alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. The slave shall go out alone. So here are three possible situations. The slave can enter slavery alone, single, and then he serves his 6 years, and then he leaves single. Second possibility is he can come in married, already married when he enters slavery. Well, then he's going to leave with his wife as a free woman when his 6 years are up. Third possibility is he enters into his master's service, and then his master gives him his wife, so he gets married during his slavery. Gets married because his master gives him a wife. Now that wife, whether she has children or not, remains with the master, does not go out at the end of the 6 year period when the slave leaves. He should go out alone without the wife. Now, does this law not foster the separation of families, as many commentators ask? It's a logical question. Let me give you some possible answers to this. First of all, if the slave is given a wife by the master and he likes the master and he wants to remain married to his wife, he could voluntarily continue as a slave using the procedure where you get your ear driven with an awl into a doorpost of the master, that sermon, which we'll look at later, and that would give him the right to stay married to his wife. But that would assume that the slave owner was kind, because the slave would not desire to be a lifelong slave of a cruel or indifferent master, so he would have a choice. Do I want to stay with my wife, or do I want to leave this crappy master of mine? But that is a mitigation of the situation, as most of the commentators point out. John Gill points out that the wife was a concubine, and most of the commentators do agree with that. I don't know how Gill knows that, but we'll see that it's, as we go through here, that the slave that is given to the slave wife that's given to the slave is probably a foreigner and is probably a concubine. Well, let's look at the third possible answer to the charge that this law fosters the separation of families. Marriage to a Canaanite was not pleasing to God, and so there's nothing wrong with breaking up such a marriage, as John Gill and the commentator Poole say. This law that's mentioned here in verse 4 that says that a slave wife cannot leave when the male husband slave is freed, that law would hinder Hebrew slaves from marrying Canaanite women, because they would think, well, I better not marry this woman. The master wants me to marry a Canaanite woman. He'll give her to me. But if I do that, I won't be able to take her back with me, so I think I won't marry her. And, of course, that was a constant concern of the law, that Hebrew Israelites not marry Canaanites. Now, Albert Barnes, the commentator, says that an after-acquired slave wife must be assumed to be foreign. Now, why is that? Well, she was Hebrew and the master gave the male slave a Hebrew slave wife, in 6 years, that Hebrew slave wife would be free by law. And so this condition would not apply, that he go out alone, that the slave would leave the master's service alone, because he could take his wife with him when she was free. So this is probably a Canaanite wife who would not be free, and who the Hebrew slave would lose forever if he decides to leave the master's service. Now, the commentator Poole says that God can override his laws in special circumstances, and he's making the point that, look, even if God has set up the holy institution of marriage, he can override it when it comes to the case of being married to Canaanite slaves. And there's something to be said about that. Recall the efforts of Haggai and Zechariah to rebuild the second temple and the return from the exile, and I forgot which one it was. I think it was Ezra, when he finds out that all the Hebrews are marrying all the pagans around, and he says, you come here, divorce them all. And he made them divorce their wives. Well, that's typically not what God would do, because God hates divorce, but that was a special circumstance. Benson, the commentator Benson, makes the point that a master might allow the freed slaves to cohabit with his female slave. In other words, I'm not going to free the female slave, but I will let the newly freed Hebrew slave of mine come and live with the female slave. I don't care, just let him live on the premises. Maybe I'll hire him while he lives with my female slave. And here's another consideration, too. This is my thinking. If an after-acquired slave wife was allowed freedom, then masters wouldn't allow a slave marriage, because the male Hebrew slave would go to his master and say, oh, that cute Canaanite slave woman of yours, I'd like to marry her, and I'm going to marry her because God in his law says that you must free her. Well, then, if that were the case, the master would say, well, in that case, I'm not going to let you marry her because I don't want to lose my slave. If the law says that all you have to do to free my slaves is just to marry one of them and walk out of here, I'm going to lose my slaves. So I'm not going to let you get married. And of course, that would hurt the institution of marriage. And in fact, it might encourage Hebrew men slaves to shack up with the Canaanite slaves. Well, all of that's interesting speculation. But as one commentator indelicately put it, the baby follows the belly, or something to that effect. And this is typical in all slave societies. When you have a slave that has a kid, the kid belongs to the master, and the kid goes with the mother, not with the father. We go now to Exodus 21, verses 5 and 6. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost. And his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. Now, when the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, he's probably talking about his Canaanite wife. Because if he's talking about a Hebrew wife, the Hebrew wife would be free after 6 years. And so he probably wouldn't have to worry about this business about getting nailed to the doorpost. He could just wait 6 years and walk out with his wife. I think that this wife here is probably being referred to, that is being referred to as probably a Canaanite wife that the slave is thinking about, because he's going to lose her forever, according to the law, because he can't go out with a Canaanite wife, a Canaanite slave wife. So in that case, he might be tempted to go through the awl ceremony and be the permanent slave of the master so he can be with his wife permanently. That's probably what's going on here. If it was a Hebrew wife, the slave husband could just wait for the 6 year and then walk out with the slave wife, and he would have less incentive to get his ear nailed to the doorpost. Now, I can imagine why this might apply to a situation where a Hebrew slave is married to a Hebrew female slave, because he might have to wait 6 years before he sees her. Let's say that her 6 years have still got to run and he gets free. And he will have to wait 6 years. He's thinking, I don't want to wait 6 years. I think I'll just go get my ear pierced with an awl and be the permanent slave of my master so I can be with my wife now. I can see that happening. If the slave decides he wants to be a lifelong slave, the master should bring this slave to God. The NIV has before the judges. And then in a note in the NIV, it says, or before God, translation issue there. But it's common to equate God with judges. In Psalm 82, verse 1, God takes his stand in his own congregation. He judges in the midst of the rulers. So God judges. And then 5 verses later in Psalms 82, verse 6, I said, you are gods. You judges are gods. You are all sons of the Most High. So gods are called judges. So master shall bring him to God or to the judges, as the NIV note says. We're going to make this legal. And after the judges find out that the slave is going to be a permanent slave and not a six-year slave, then the master shall bring the slave to the door or the doorpost. Bringing the slave to the door shows how close to the master's house the voluntary slave will be. There's some symbolism there. And then the awl is pierced in the ear. That's to show that the slave was bound to hear all of his master's orders, according to Gill and Clark. It's an interesting verse in Psalm 40, verses 6 through 8, about having your ears opened. Sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired. My ears you have opened. Now, the New American Study Bible note says that open there is literally dug. So it would read like this, literally. My ears you have dug. The New American Standard Bible note says that word possibly means pierced, so it might read, my ears, you have pierced. So if this is the proper translation, it probably refers to one becoming a voluntary slave. My ears, you have pierced. We go on in that psalm, verse 7, I said, behold, I come in the scroll of the book, it is written for me, I delight to do your will, O my God, your law is within my heart. The idea here is that a voluntary slave delights to do the will of his master. Of course, that's perfect typology of the spiritual slavery, if I put it in air quotes, the spiritual servitude that Christians have when we follow Jesus. He makes us free by making us a slave. This ceremony of the awl is also mentioned in Deuteronomy 15:17. Then you shall take an awl and pierce it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your servant forever. Also, you shall do likewise to your maidservant. So this ceremony was for female slaves as well as male slaves. Now, I said that this slavery is permanent once the ear is pierced with the awl. John Gill says it means permanent until the year of Jubilee. And Clark says the same thing. Perhaps there's a verse that says that. I don't have it with me, but that could be for 49 years until the next Jubilee. Exodus 21, 7 through 8. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. Now, why would a man sell his daughter as a female slave? Well, it's because he's poor. He can't pay his creditor off, so he says, here, you take my daughter and you marry her and we'll be even. Now, that sounds harsh, but remember, it's only for 6 years if they weren't to get married. And if they were to get married, the husband had to support her. And if she's going to be an unmarried slave in this creditor's house, the creditor would have to provide for the girl's food and shelter, which the father probably could not do because he was poor. Now, it says if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. That's assuming she marries the creditor, the slave owner. She marries him, and well, then after 6 years, obviously she's not going to, can't leave because the marriage law will trump the slavery redemption law. The Cambridge Commentary will back me up on this. Says, quote, the reason for the different treatment of female slaves is to be found in the fact that a female slave was, as a rule, her master's concubine. She stood consequently to her master in a relation which could not suitably be terminated at the end of 6 years. No, you're not going to kill that marriage because of the law of freedom in the seventh year. Now, what happens if the master does not marry her when he was supposed to, when he agreed to do it? Well, he could keep her as a slave, I guess, and take care of her properly and do all the laws that masters are required to do on behalf of their slaves. Or, it says here in verse 8, then he shall let her be redeemed. In other words, her father could buy her back because the master, apparently unfairly, did not marry her. Now, this is important because since the father has the right of redemption of his female slave daughter, this will keep the slave owner, the creditor, from selling that girl to a foreign nation, in which case the father would lose his daughter forever. So the law protects the daughter from letting that happen and protects the father. Verse 8 mentions the unfairness of the master. He does not have authority to sell the slave to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. It's because he takes one look at her and says, I don't like the way she smiles. I don't like the way she laughs. I don't like the way she cooks. I'm not going to carry out my marriage contract with the girl's father. I'm just going to sell her to the Amorites or something, or to the Ammonites or something like that. No, you can't do that. Couldn't do that. Now, one interesting question I have here is, if the law allows the father to redeem his daughter, where is he going to get the money from? He just sold her into slavery because he didn't have any money. Well, I speculate other kinfolk could come up with a redemption money, could help with that because of the serious situation. They would likely want to help. And if the slave girl is to be free at the weekly Sabbath year, that means the price of the slave girl would be reduced by 1/6 every year. So the closer you got to redemption, the easier it is would be for the father to come up with the money to buy her back out. Well, that's assuming that the 7 years is not fixed for every slave. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate, well, what happens if nobody can afford to pay the redemption money and the girl is still a slave? Well, the master must still provide for her to maintain her. She must be in a suitable condition as his intended wife. If not, her freedom must be instantly granted. Now, I don't know how Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown know that, but that's what they say. So, basically, the law here protects girls who are sold into slavery. We go now to verses 9 through 11, Exodus 21. If he, that's the master, the slave buyer who's buying the female girl, the female slave, if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. The father shall deal with the slave girl according to the custom of daughters. In other words, he's got to treat this slave girl just like a daughter for his son. If he takes to himself another woman, now, first of all, according to the custom of daughters, that means that the son needs to marry her. If he doesn't, she gets her dowry back. The son's got to provide her conjugal rights, got to provide her financial support and all that. And, of course, the father would be over that. In verse 10, if he takes to himself another woman, and that's either the father or the son, I'm not really sure. I think it's the father. If he marries the woman and then marries another slave woman, well, the temptation would be to reduce the amount being paid to the second woman. The law says, no, you don't. You can't reduce her food or clothing or her conjugal rights. When a man had more than one wife, ancient Near Eastern custom and law said that he had to provide sex with each one of them on a regular rotating basis where one concubine was not favored over the other. In fact, they had fixed nights where the man had to come in and do his duty. Whew, I can't help but think that would probably be one of the more pleasant duties that we face in this life, a lot more pleasant than going to work. But at any rate, he would have to do that, and he might decide he likes other concubines better than this concubine, and so he says, well, you know, I think I'm going to ignore you on your Tuesday night. I'm too tired. I want to watch a ball game, whatever. Can't do that, according to the law. You got to give her her conjugal rights equal to all the other concubines, and her clothes, and her food. And in fact, if you don't, verse 11, if he will not, if the slave owner will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. In other words, she doesn't have to be redeemed. She's free as a bird. So the woman can either be redeemed by her father if the husband's not treating her right, if he refuses to marry her, or if he does marry her and takes another concubine and reduces the slave girl's money or quits having sex with her or whatever, she's free of charge. She walks out. So the law protects the slave girl. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm going to stop it right here at verse 11 with our discussion of Hebrew slavery. In our next audio, I'll take up the last half of Exodus 21, verses 12 through 36, and we'll look at restitution, a very important area of the law. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.